The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and this, my friends, is one of those moments.
This story shall the good man teach his son. And Crispin Crispian shall ne'er go by from this day to the ending of the world. But we in it shall be remembered. We few. We happy few.
Perhaps it's not the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, but this debate in 2016 between Hillary Clinton and Donald J. Trump rivals anything we've witnessed up to now in American politics.
There you go again.
As a matter of fact, your question brings out a point that I'm very glad to make.
And that we have fewer ships than we did in 1916. Well, Governor, we also have fewer horses and bayonets.
But can you get things done? And I believe I can.
Not just people saying, I'm going to go fix it, but what are we going to do?
Loaded down with goodies.
You ought to be in the White House.
I am not going to exploit my opponent's youth and inexperience.
In 1984, a bitter Shakespearean-sounding Richard Nixon recalled his debate defeat in 1960 and told all to beware the television cameras.
I would urge all prospective candidates in the future, be sure that you remember that more important than what you say is how you look on television.
Our partners at Retro Report say the debates are important for a reason. Whatever you want to say about gaffes and sweaty brows, they are meaningful. Eric German is a producer at Retro Report and offered up this moment in 1988 as an example of how content and showbiz are inextricable. Here's 1988 debate moderator Bernard Shaw.
If Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?
No, I don't, Bernard, and I think you know that I've opposed the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent. And
the public persona of Michael Dukakis was being put to the test here, right? This is an unscripted moment of conflict that has very high stakes. And Michael Dukakis was regarded in many quarters as kind of an emotionless technocrat who didn't really understand, you know, the felt lives of his constituents. And in this moment, in this unscripted moment, he dramatized that problem to his own detriment.
Do mistakes matter? Do fact mistakes matter? Do they reveal character, or are they more the quiz show kind of thing?
I mean, I think it depends upon the particular candidate and what their public persona is, right? And this isn't a question of fact, but it's another debate where in the 1990s, George Bush, the elder George Bush, got caught looking at his watch in a town hall.
I still remember it.
When a woman was asking him a question about how the economy affected the lives of regular folks. And Bill Clinton later said, I think correctly, that if it had been me looking at my watch, it probably wouldn't have played the same way, right? Because Bush looking at his watch was a reflection of his public persona. It demonstrated problems he'd already been having in the campaign, which was Bush was a very wealthy guy who actually didn't know what it was like to go to the grocery store and not be able to afford food. And so these things, asking yourself whether it's really real or really authentic or not is less useful probably than asking yourself, does this moment in the debate help dramatize the public persona of the candidate in a way that's useful to the electorate?
People don't remember that during the 1970s that there was a period of sort of detente where the U.S. and the Soviet Union were kind of coming together to try to get rid of nuclear arms and to control the spread of nuclear arms. And the extent to which that so deluded Gerald Ford into thinking that the Russians were allies came out in the debate, and an argument against détente, you could not have made a better point than this right here.
There is no Soviet domination of Eastern Europe, and there never will be under a Ford administration.
I'm sorry, could I just follow? Did I understand you to say, sir, that the Russians are not
using Eastern Europe as their own sphere of influence and occupying most of the countries there.
It was a very bad moment for
Ford.
And it demonstrates, in a way, Ford's tin ear for how his words are playing. And he was trying to say, we don't accept the Soviet domination of Eastern Europe. We don't stand for it. We don't even accept that that it has been successfully dominated. And he doubled down, and he dug in his heels, and he ended up sounding like he didn't know what was going on. And it allowed Democrats to open up a bunch of questions about whether or not Ford really had the mental fortitude to do the job.
The classic disentanglement of the persona questions and the substance questions in the old Kennedy-Nixon debate is the myth, perhaps, that Kennedy won the TV debate, but Nixon maintained that he won the radio debate. If you heard it or looked at the transcript, it looked like Nixon won, but nobody did anything but watch TV for that debate, and so it didn't really matter. Is that what you found?
There's a sort of oft-repeated myth about the Kennedy-Nixon debate, and it always centers on a couple of very vivid and salient details. One of the details is makeup. One of the details is radio. And it's Kennedy wore the right kind of makeup. Nixon wore the wrong kind. Nixon looked terrible. Kennedy looked great. And Kennedy wins the debate. And the way that we prove this, the way that we prove that Kennedy wins on looks alone, is that there's this other anecdote out there, the so-called evidence that radio listeners actually preferred Nixon. The problem with this story, and like any of the sort of half-true stories that we all tell, is that there's no good evidence to support the idea that Nixon won on the radio. And the other question is, who would have been listening to this debate on the radio? In 1960, something like 9 out of 10 households already had televisions, right? So even if you could find a poll that was conducted according to decent scientific standards, and there aren't any, but even if you could find one that showed Nixon won on the radio, the big question would be, aren't these already huge statistical outliers anyway?
They're truckers. They would be truckers.
I don't know who they would be, you know. But it's just that so this is a story that we started telling about presidential debates at the very dawn of this tradition. And there's a way that this misplaced focus remains with us now. And this idea that there are tricks that can somehow win a debate that have nothing to do with the substance of the debate helps explain a lot of the really silly coverage that you see now. People dissecting the body language, people parsing particular words and things like this. And it misses the fact that you don't win presidential debates with a trick. And the reason why they are so widely watched, the reason why voters like them, is not because they're stupid. It's not because they're deluded about what's happening. It's because, let's give them the benefit of a doubt, there's actually something useful that we see.
Eric German is a producer for Retro Report. You can watch his look back at presidential debates at thetakeaway.org. So which are you in all this? Anxious? Are you excited? Or just plain worn out? A pair of our very well-prepared and passionate listeners was eager to let us see their hopes and butterflies about the biggest political debate of their lifetimes. Kevin Loney is a salesman and a Trump supporter. Lisa Hansen is a classical flutist, an author, and a Hillary supporter. Kevin and Lisa, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
A lot of anticipation for tonight. Kevin, how are you feeling about it right about now?
I'm pretty excited about it. I can't wait to see what unfolds and, you know, some hopefully new stuff that we will learn.
And Lisa?
Honestly, I feel a little bit anxious. I'm excited for Hillary to have a chance to redefine herself, and I hope that the public is open to that, those in the electorate who have been against her but are still undecided.
How much do you think is on the line here, Lisa?
Well, I would hope that not everything boils down to one night, but I've lived long enough to know that it could. So I think that there's a lot on the line for her.
So it's an all-in moment politically, Lisa. In your lifetime, have you ever witnessed such a moment before?
Again, I wouldn't characterize it completely as an all-in moment, because I would hope that were there some kind of unfortunate statement that one could come back and recover, because I don't feel that our democracy should come down to those one statements, those moments. But I have seen, you know, I remember the great Lloyd Benson remark to Dan Quayle that I don't think he ever recovered from.
All right, Kevin Loney, how are you feeling? What do you think is on the line tonight?
I'm very excited about it because I think it's going to force Donald to bring some meat and potatoes to the table. I also hope that he will put a spotlight on some of the things that Hillary claims that she's done that she hasn't. And it's a wake-up call to the people who are undecided.
Kevin, let me elaborate on this question of meat and potatoes. Do you think this is something that Trump is capable of doing?
Oh, definitely. I mean, if you look at him from a businessman's point of view, he could not have accomplished what he has without bringing meat and potatoes. And up till now, I think at times, yeah, he's played the showman. He hasn't shown his cards. He hasn't gone deep because maybe he's not ready. But, you know, I hate to say, use a coin of phrase, the art of the deal, but every deal has certain variables in it. You don't know what the other side is bringing. You have to be able to read that, put together a plan to either win them over or get around them. I'm looking forward to him showing us why he'll put together a cabinet of really good people, smart people, put together a plan to do things that are right for the deal. And the deal is to make America great again.
What about, Lisa, you know, they say a third of the electorate hasn't really weighed in on this campaign at all, and that they've probably heard a lot of stuff. They probably heard a lot that, you know, Donald Trump is some kind of nut. What if that third tunes in and after tonight says, oh, for heaven's sakes, he's not so bad? What do you feel?
That's the danger, if he can contain himself. And, you know, we'll see. Obviously, he's got his handlers, and they're going to try to get him not to be a bully, which may be difficult, not to insult, not to belittle. I hope that that undecided segment of the electorate wakes up, pays attention, thinks about substance, not just the show that's going on. Yes, we know. I will give Trump that he is a gifted TV reality performer.
Kevin, what's your worst-case scenario? Lisa's sort of saying that the worst-case scenario for her is if people think Trump's not so bad after tonight. What do you think, Kevin?
Well, I'm hoping that after tonight that some people will wake up and realize that Hillary is that bad.
All right, Kevin, appreciate it. Kevin and Lisa are both takeaway listeners. Kevin Loney is a salesman and a Trump supporter. Lisa Hansen is a classical flutist, an author, and a Hillary Clinton supporter.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
As history begins to see the long war in Syria through a bloody and clarifying lens, the precedents of this conflict show a preference for all-out slaughter over real military tactics, a preference for medieval sieges and targeting of civilians by killing doctors and attacking relief operations. Diplomats may talk about another ceasefire to replace the one that broke down last week. Meanwhile, another 26 died, many in hospitals, damaged in airstrikes over the weekend. UN Special Envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, has called the recent days chilling and the past week one of the worst ones in Syria during the nearly 6 years of this devastating conflict. That's his quote. Anne Bernard is Beirut bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times. She joins me now. Anne, how have you been able to piece this story together?
It's always really hard to report on Syria these days because there's less and less access to what's happening on the ground physically. So as usual, we are in touch with many people that are living in East Aleppo, whether they're doctors or anti-government activists or random civilians, teachers, others, and also with international organizations, people in West Aleppo on in the government-held side, and just as many people as we can who know about different aspects of the situation.
And how does the consensus begin to be that this is a strategy, that there's no caught in the crossfire randomness about this? This is a strategic.
Well, it's been 5.5 years of war, and it's been pretty clear long before the Russians became as deeply involved as they are, before they began their direct intervention with aerial attacks about a year ago. The Syrian government, which was always close to Russia and advised by it as well, has made it clear that if an area is controlled by opposition fighters, they will use a scorched earth tactic. We've seen that in the suburbs of Damascus. You can be standing in the middle of the capital and hear the outgoing artillery fire hitting its own suburbs. We've seen in the old city of Homs be completely destroyed, and eventually the people evacuated from there. Most of them still have not come back.
How would you describe the destruction in Aleppo as being of a different scale than what we've already seen? And what would you make of any effort by the government to completely retake Aleppo? What would that take?
It's not easy. There isn't a ground force on the Syrian government side that is capable of really taking and holding large areas on the ground. So either they're going to have to rely on some new injection of ground troops. There's been speculation about Russian ground troops, or they'll do what they've done in the past, which is bombard the place to smithereens and try to starve it and eventually try to make a deal where people surrender and come out. But again, in the past, it has taken years to do that. And this is a larger area with bigger stockpiles and more people and more territory than any other place where they've tried this strategy before.
I mean, are the Russians taking a page from their scorched earth policy in Afghanistan a generation ago?
Yes, and the more recent example is Grozny in Chechnya. When Putin had not been in power very long, one of the things that really brought him to prominence was his prosecution of the war in Chechnya, which is a semi-autonomous republic in Russia, which wanted to become fully independent. And basically the strategy was to completely bomb it to the ground and then rebuild it and install a leader who's loyal to Moscow.
There's a grisly message from pro-government militia that you can see in certain places in Syria, and this would seem to describe it. What is that?
There have been graffiti written that say, starve or surrender. And that's after, in the past, another slogan was scrawled which said, Assad or we burn the country. But starve or surrender is essentially the tactic that's been used to try to empty rebellious areas, first with heavy bombardment and then with either allowing some people to come out and then continuing to bombard the people who stay, or eventually striking a deal under which people surrender by either going back to government areas or being bussed to rebel-held areas. And both of those choices carry risk for people. But sometimes after years of deprivation and danger, they agree to take it.
Given what a fiasco this recent ceasefire was, is there any military countermeasure that the U.S. or the allies who claim to represent the anti-government or anti-ISIS forces can do to slow this down in Aleppo?
So proposals have floated around for years for various ways to ground the warplanes of the Syrian government, which are believed to be the biggest killer of civilians in the conflict. You could have a formal no-fly zone, or short of that, you could bomb runways and planes on the ground as a deterrent or as a preventive measure, or announce you will shoot down Syrian aircraft that bomb civilians, just sort of a no-bomb zone, and that might be all it takes. But there's no sign that the White House would consider those options. The shorthand understanding of this is that they don't want to get involved in another Middle East intervention after the disaster in Iraq, and the American public feels the same way. But the thing is, the U.S. is involved. They're backing some rebel groups and anti-ISIS groups, and at the same time, they're actively preventing their own allies from providing anti-aircraft weapons to the Syrian rebels that might be able to shoot down some of those planes. The Syrian opposition now says, we don't expect the U.S. to do anything to protect civilians, but then it shouldn't stop others from doing so. And most of all, it shouldn't legitimize the killers by engaging in fruitless negotiations with the same people, the Russians, who are backing Assad's air war.
Anne Bernard, Beirut bureau chief for our partner, The New York Times, speaking to us from Beirut. Thanks so much, Anne.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Jose Fernandez, the 24-year-old ace pitcher for the Miami Marlins, was killed this weekend in a tragic boating accident. He He played his last game on Tuesday against the Washington Nationals in a stellar performance that only adds to his reputation as one of the best pitchers in baseball. Fernandez was more than a rookie of the year and an all-star. His story of escaping Cuba at 15 with his mother resonated with so many in the Cuban community in Miami, which this week is reeling at the news of his death. Luis Hernandez, morning host at WLRN in Miami, says everyone in Miami's Cuban community has a story about Jose Fernandez.
Talking to a lot of Cuban Americans here in Miami, I just wanted to get a sense of what was at the core of their emotions. And the word that I kept hearing was family. He wasn't just a hero. He was more than a baseball star. He was family. And really because they connected to him, because he represented their story. I mean, he's that story of the Cuban who tried to defect many times, failed, was in a Cuban prison, eventually made it. And he's the rags to riches story. I mean, he's the quintessential rags to riches story. And so they look at him as he was one of us. That's what they felt. They've always felt that. And for him to die, especially at such a young age and the way he did, and that's not lost on people. You know, he made it to this country on a boat and then he died on a boat. And it stung in so many ways.
As far as baseball talent is concerned, give me a sense, remind us of just how top of the line Jose Fernandez was.
The fact that he came out, I mean, he went from, you know, he had 1 year in the minors, let's put it that way. And anybody that knows baseball understands how fast a meteoric rise he had. If you don't know baseball, usually you start in single A, you work your way up to double A, then triple A, then maybe you get a shot at the big leagues. This kid went from, you know, the bottom of the minors straight to the majors in almost a year. And that's rare. He was the rookie of the year and then last year had a phenomenal season. Everybody just talked about this is the next great one. You know, he had a variety of pitches, but his fastball was ridiculous, really. And he just had a confidence, a bravado. He wasn't cocky because he never disrespected his opponents, but he just had this confidence on the mound. And whenever he pitched, because it's the Marlins and anybody from down here knows it's not, we don't have a winning team, but when he pitched, there was always hope. Oh, we're going to win. It's Jose. He's on the mound.
Luis Hernandez, it's the end of the season. And for an accident like this to happen, just as you get into the playoffs in the World Series, really casts a shadow on all of baseball, don't you think?
It does. It was hard to watch, really, sports last night. You see players from all around the league, especially other Cuban players, and the emotion was just really high. Yesterday, I think the hardest thing to watch was, obviously, they canceled the game against Atlanta, and they set up this makeshift memorial on the mound. They basically just put his number 16 on there. And Marlins players came out one at a time or a couple at a time and grieved. And I think the one that really hit me the hardest was D. Gordon was out there. And he was standing at first, then he fell to his knees and just it was hard. It was really hard. And look, the season's almost over. And the Marlins mathematically may still have a chance to get in the playoffs. But there's just a feeling of we just want the season to end. And then just had the chance to really mourn and deal with this. And like anything else, when we lose someone we love, eventually we find a way to move on.
Luis Hernandez is a morning host for WLRN in Miami. Thank you so much, Luis.
Thank you, John.
The golf world is mourning the death at 87 of one of the most successful players of any sport. Arnold Palmer, holder of numerous golf records, some that may never be broken, passed away after suffering heart trouble. Palmer was the face of golf for more than a generation, and today is the face of its golden age.
Getting around the country in comfort and style, for me, that has to be a Cadillac.
Every morning, whether I'm here in Latrobe or on the road, I'm out there making sure all the parts are working.
Well, am I surprised? I suppose I'm gratified that people still recognize and know, and I appreciate that.
Cindy Boren, Washington Post sports writer, says Palmer went beyond golf to define the business of sports itself.
He helped commercialize it. He helped popularize it. This is a man who became incredibly wealthy away from the golf course through his business dealings. And yet he always remained, you know, sort of a common person. I think a lot of golf fans related to him in a way that they really couldn't to Jack Nicklaus. He was cool. You know, he would go on TV and he had the kind of cool personality and self-deprecating manner that made him really popular. Some of his Johnny Carson interviews are just classics. People just followed him in a way that they really didn't with anyone else. He was also fortunate, of course, to have the rivalry with Jack Nicklaus, you know, stoking his popularity somewhat too. But, you know, he really did change the game.
And he holds records that may never be broken and was always approachable. I mean, he's not the kind of person who, you know, lived in a private jet. He was just out there with the crowds.
He didn't really forget his roots as the son of a former groundskeeper. He was very willing to stand and sign autographs all day long. People could talk to him. They could approach him in restaurants. You will recall that he also invented a drink, the Arnold Palmer, which is lemonade and iced tea.
Start off with a drink glass, ice with a scoop. Simple, Arnold Palmer is half lemon and half iced tea.
Whether he actually came up with the idea or not, he's credited with it, and it's named for him. And it's pretty delicious, by the way.
And as far as business is concerned, is it the case that every millionaire sports figure with an endorsement from Nike or someone else owes a thank you to Arnold Palmer?
Yeah, maybe they should send him a few dollars, like maybe, 2% of their cut. They really do. He was endorsing golf equipment. He was designing golf clubs. You know, Nicklaus was doing it too, but Palmer was different. And what Palmer brought to it was really the willingness to be out there shaking hands, doing the side of the business that you don't really see when it's getting off the ground. He was willing to talk to people. He was willing to address corporate leaders. He was constantly working away from the golf course.
And his longevity is quite remarkable as well. I mean, he's really been there right up until his death. I mean, there's never a Masters tournament that doesn't mention Palmer. There's rarely a golf event that doesn't echo something that Palmer did. He's really someone who is there from beginning to end.
Only in the last couple of years has he really been in rather frail health. You know, he would still do hit the ceremonial tee shots at some of the majors. And, you know, he was always one of the most popular guys, frankly, at the majors in the days leading up to the competition. The people were there to see Arnie.
Cindy Boren, Washington Post sports writer. Thank you so much, Cindy.
My pleasure.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
From Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And Staples, with copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom framed prints and posters. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Just like I pictured it.
New York City, tourist destination, movie backdrop, center of power and money.
We make the rules, pal. The news, war, peace, famine, upheaval, the price of a paperclip. We pick that rabbit out of the hat while everybody sits out there wondering how the hell we did it. Now, you're not naive enough to think we're living in a democracy, are you, buddy?
Money never left New York, but power, political power, pulled up stakes a while ago. It went west and south. New York City, once the kingmaker engine of American politics, hasn't produced a presidential candidate of note since FDR. But in 2016, suddenly we have the ultimate showdown between power and money. Clinton versus Trump. Hillary Clinton, who built her power base by becoming a New York senator and whose current address is in Westchester County, and Donald J. Trump, who owns more buildings than Gordon Gekko could dream of. The White House would be the first building Donald Trump would live in that he doesn't own. To find two New York behemoths at the center of the political universe, you'd have to go all the way back to the 19-teens and 20s, to when the Tammany Hall political machine ruled. Synonymous with urban corruption and machine politics, it was just the target a rising young progressive reformer named Franklin Delano Roosevelt would mark for destruction. To get at Tammany Hall, Roosevelt, the patrician, educated man of money, would have to take down power himself. Four-term New York Governor Al Smith, Tammany's most beloved son. Historian Terry Galway's book, Machine Made, Tammany Hall and the Creation of Modern American Politics, says the battle between Smith and young FDR would change the world.
For Franklin Roosevelt, Tammany Hall was almost the epitome of evil politics. And of course, historically, I mean, he was correct. But what Franklin Roosevelt didn't see until, I would argue, the 1920s, is that in the 19-teens, a new generation of Tammany politicians was coming to power with an understanding that government could be used to better people's lives. With the rise of somebody like Al Smith, who had literally dropped out of grammar school 2 months before his graduation because he needed to find work, the dynamic changed, and Tammany Hall became this instrument for social progress.
He may have been an old, uneducated has-been to progressives like Roosevelt, but Al Smith could see farther into the future than FDR. As a New York State senator, Smith led the investigation into the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory blaze of 1911, in which 146 young, mostly female immigrant workers were killed, making it the city's deadliest industrial accident. Smith found that a crisis, a disaster, was a political opportunity. Healing the wounds from an industrial accident delivered votes that no amount of corrupt political patronage could match.
Out of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, you have things like the beginnings of the minimum wage. Well, what does that have to do with fireplace safety? Nothing, except that Smith and others saw the opportunity for real, profound change in American society. And then once Smith becomes governor, you know, they set in place the modern social welfare system that we know today.
It was this big picture of Smith's that Roosevelt missed, all caught up in his political chess game against Tammany. Roosevelt couldn't beat them, so eventually, he joined them.
Al Smith's sort of progressivism had everything to do with improving the condition of working people's lives. And I think that Roosevelt saw that it was working. The pragmatist in Roosevelt, and he was a pragmatist at the end of the day, the pragmatist saw that not only was it working, it was getting votes for people like Al Smith.
Roosevelt found he needed to learn at the foot of the master, despite the unsavory reputation of the past. And FDR softened his combative style after he nearly died contracting a permanent paralyzing disease, probably polio, back in 1921.
Roosevelt clearly becomes this heroic figure after polio, where before, I would argue, he was an amateur politician. But polio made him a different person and allowed him to work hand in glove with figures he would have excoriated a decade before. And it certainly helped him form this very important relationship.
Protestant Roosevelt enthusiastically nominated Al Smith as the country's first Catholic presidential candidate at the 1928 Democratic National Convention, where he refers to Smith as the happy warrior.
We offer one who has the will to win, who not only deserves success, but commands it. Victory is his habit. The happy warrior, Alfred E. Smith.
And it was that happy warrior who encouraged Roosevelt to run for his vacant governor's seat, a post Roosevelt narrowly won the same year Smith lost his bid for president. Roosevelt's subsequent rise to power and Smith's loss of it ultimately spelled the end of their relationship. And Smith's contribution to the New Deal is rarely, if ever, mentioned.
Franklin Roosevelt really never acknowledged publicly what he said privately to people like Francis Perkins, that the New Deal was invented in many ways by Al Smith, by his Tammany cohorts in New York in the 1920s.
So when you watch Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump tonight, just think of old Al Smith, the folksy shoot-from-the-hip man of the people, and Roosevelt, the man with the familiar dynasty name.
Now, boys, all together for Al Smith. Here he comes, all together.
We now know, though, it was New York's Mr. Roosevelt, not New York's Mr. Smith, who went to Washington in the end.
Trust. You are now on the inside of what I like to call circle of trust.
You want me to trust you? Don't use big words you don't understand.
News consumers have gone into their corners.
It's time for who do you trust? Hubba, hubba, hubba. Money, money, money. Who do you trust?
What we have to begin to do is look to ourselves.
I've given up why and trusting.
Trust in me. Just in me.
If trust is the emotional currency of politics, then this first debate between Clinton and Trump is a contest to see whose vision of the nation's future is closer to the trustworthiness of gold and which looks more like worthless paper. All this week, we are exploring this most important of intangible qualities in a variety of very tangible places. It's a series we're calling Got Trust? Exploring Faith and Suspicion in the 21st Century. What institutions do Americans trust and why? Take water and the folks who deliver it. Water is a very tangible substance that we don't want to have to think about, right? Clear, pure water is what we all prefer to drink. Can we trust what comes out of the tap? Ask the folks in Flint, Michigan, or Hinckley, California, or Hoosick Falls, New York. Erin Brockovich knows the value of trust and how difficult it is to restore. She won a $333 million judgment against polluters in Hinckley, California, 20 years ago. Brockovich says her career has taught her that trust is priceless, and those who lose it need to know a few other hard-learned lessons.
Superman's not coming. That's my new tagline. Because they've had this idea and this expectation that somebody or something was overseeing a situation that would never allow this to happen. And so they now face the fact that what they trusted, they realized they shouldn't have or they can't. And it's disappointment, it's sadness, it's fear, it's confusion, and it's anger.
We take trust for granted, I think. When we put a stamp on this is clean water, communities aren't involved in that process. It's just sort of given to them, boom. Mm-hmm. So when it goes wrong, they don't have any power to do anything about it other than, you know, maybe go to the judiciary, maybe move and get out of town. What are we doing wrong?
You know, I've looked at that ever since I began my work back in 1991, dare I date myself. My dad, I was born and raised in the Midwest, and he was an industrial engineer, and he always taught me the value of our health and water and that deceptions would be our downfall. And I think about that all the time, especially when I'm in these communities. And you have to look at why that deception begins. And that's oftentimes because somebody knows something and they're afraid to come forward with that. Also, we do things, especially when it comes to our water, based on the almighty dollar. And we make a bad decision based on money, and we forget the value of transparency and the value of information that is what could really defend and protect people in knowing what to do. So fear and greed are our enemies in that regard.
And there are incentives in the system for people to push the envelope because they know people will trust. They'd rather trust.
I think that's changing. I see it in the communities that I deal with, frustration about what's going on with their water system. I mean, you look at what happened in Flint. Every one of us, rich, poor, black, white, Republican, Democrat, politicizing water on our health is a mistake. Every one of us need it. Every one of us has to have it to sustain our life. What we have to begin to do is look to ourselves educate ourselves, learn to trust ourselves.
So the first step for a responsible citizen in your experience is, why do you trust that? Is to be skeptical, is to ask questions. So on what basis do you think your water is clean? On what basis do you think you're not being poisoned? And start from there.
Oh, absolutely. If you go to my public Facebook, somebody's sending me a picture of yellow water, orange water, green water, brown water, looks like oil. And what really incites them is an agency or a water municipality telling them, oh, but it's safe to drink. And they're like, are you kidding me? There's this common sense moment for them. I remember that happened for me in Hinckley. I was literally looking at a frog with two heads in green water, and somebody was trying to convince me what I saw wasn't real and it couldn't hurt you.
Who in your experience stands out to you as someone who's really suffered the toxin of losing trust and going through life having trusted and then suddenly not being able to trust anything anymore and feeling that there's no way to get that back?
It wouldn't be one person.
Yeah, I'm sure not.
It would be thousands and hundreds of communities. You know, I was really recently moved. We're heavily involved in all this groundwater contamination with PFOA. Everyone would recognize it when I say the word Teflon. And it is rampant. And what set this new PFOA situation into motion was the EPA had a guideline for this chemical, because we know it's toxic, for a very long time. And that level was 400 parts per billion. It was very high. Well, just recently, they decided that guideline's too high. Oops, we better drop it. So they dropped it to 70. So now we have all these municipalities screaming, oh my gosh, we're way in exceedance of that. So the community of Hoosick Falls came to me. And when you ingest PFOAs, they don't come out. You don't secrete them out. You don't urinate them out. They're in you. And a national average, and I'm not really sure the measurement that they use, you know, micrograms or in blood, but it's a 2 is a median because PFOA is in so many of our products. There's people up in the Hoosick Fall area coming in with levels at 50 to 55 to 60. It's outrageous. So their future, if we have a latency period and this is a cancer-causing compound, doesn't look too bright. For me, the water issue, the pollution of our water, the health impacts and the ramifications hasn't gotten better. It's gotten worse.
Why do people cling to their trust? Because they feel it's so perfect. It's kind of utopian. When it feels like, oh, my God, I don't want to go and test for all those things. I'd rather just look at the water and go, oh, it's fine.
When we lose trust, I think we feel we lose hope. And as long as we don't know, we always have hope. But even when you do know, you have greater hope. Now we make different decisions. Now we find a cleaner source. Now we find a solution. Now we know our health outcome. We always think that things come from the top down, and we really know it begins right at home, right in your own heart, and reaching out to your neighbors. This is all something we've moved away from. I think we're going to come back to. And they know that they have support, and they have security, and that builds trust. And from there, they find strength.
Aaron Brockovich, thanks so much.
You're welcome. It's so nice to
see
you.
Yeah, so nice to see you. Tomorrow, our series on trust continues with a look at one of America's most trusted institutions, the military.
Duty, honor, and country. The environment within the military academy itself made that phrase something much more than words. It ended up translating into a code, a set of values.
Perhaps what we love most about this series, though, is the stories you are telling us by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or just go to thetakeaway.org.
Michael Pedamonte from Gaston, Oregon. The person I lost trust in was Lance Armstrong. Being a former healthcare professional and an avid cyclist, to see him do what he did was disheartening at the best.
Listen to our whole series at thetakeaway.org/trust. And thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
It's
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.